Greetings from K9 to diddly-dum, diddly-dum, diddly-dum. End of message.
Happy day, faithless listeners, and welcome to episode 132 of the Diddly Dum Podcast, the fourth best Doctor Who podcast out there. I'm Hayden.
And I'm Mark.
Yeah, so we're still waiting, unfortunately, listeners, for Doc to turn up, but he's been away all day at a conference in Downing Street, of all places.
Ooh.
I do hope he's here soon, though.
I'm not sure he's going to be able to get back into the Hoozeum, is he, Hayden? Because he set the security to keep everyone away from the museum during the lockdown. And I don't think he's given us the passwords to reset it.
No, which is curious because he didn't set the security codes to stop us from getting out. Just other people from getting in. Which is very curious. Anyway, this week, faithless listeners, we are going to be looking at a fourth Doctor story. But we're not going to give you any hints just yet.
I mean, say a tap, tap, tap at the bleeding window. What's that? You have a look on the security camera.
Oh, on the security camera, yeah?
Yeah, well,
on the camera, tap, tap, right? Okay.
Have a look and see who it is.
Oh, you but won't believe it.
It's Greta Bleeding Garbo.
It's Doc Bloody Whom.
How am I going to get through these locked doors? In the name of the Diddly Dumb Podcast. I have spoken with the Prime Minister.
And what does he say, Doc?
He says many things. He speaks of the great lockdown of life. He speaks of Skonos rising. No, sorry, I misread that. He speaks of social distancing.
Does he speak of the new personal protective equipment?
He says we shall have them, and soon.
Oh, he's not after another bloody tribute, is he?
Just votes, I think he's after.
figures.
Right, you started without me. Hey, give me that conch. Thank you.
Oh, hands off my horn, Doc. Hands off my horn. You might be a doctor on sailors, but nothing else.
Well, again, happy day, faithless listeners. We hope everything's going well. You're, I was going to say, surviving the lockdown, but I don't know if that's a particularly appropriate word. That you're getting through the lockdown with as little discomfort and whatever as possible. What's been happening since last we spoke? We've lost a few people, haven't we? I think first of all, we lost Honor Blackman, of course, who I don't know what she's more famous for, whether it's her role in Goldfinger or her role in Terror of the Vervoids.
I was so sure you're going to say the Avengers.
I think she's far more remembered for that sitcom she did with Paul McGann's brother.
I used to quite like that. The Upper Hand.
That's it.
Yes, that's it.
It's only about the last year or so that a penny dropped for me, Paul McGann's brother.
Well, I always presume that 10% of the people on television are Paul McGann's brother.
Most of the time they are.
Did I ever mention that I once met her?
No.
No,
you didn't.
I had to go around to her flat to do
What?
To do a tax audit on her.
You're joking.
Nothing suspicious, by the way. It's just a routine. Excuse me. It wasn't anything bad. It was just a routine tax audit in those days. You'd have a list of people who registered from tax, and when you wanted to go around and do a tax audit, you'd start at A, and when you got to Z, you'd go back to A again. A bit like those of you who are familiar with 2000 AD. From the late 70s, faithless listeners may remember the character of Aron A. Aardvark, the man who changed his name so that he could be first in the Megacity 1 phone book, only to find himself in an unfortunate situation when Chief Judge Cal ordered the execution of the entire city population in alphabetical order. I mean, this was, we're talking about first half of the 1990s, so a lot has changed since then. Yes, went along to a very, very swish big house in, somewhere in West London. And got a lift where you had to have a special key or something to be able to access the top floor. And, she was, I'm not just saying this because she's dead. She was lovely. Which was a surprise because you can sometimes come across people who, the richer and more famous they are, they assume that insulates them from having to play by the same rules as everyone else. Oh, you ghastly little man. What are you doing expecting me to pay my taxes like the proles do? She was... What a lady. It was like you would imagine a real film star. Well, of course, she was a real film star. But shall we say, they say don't meet your heroes, don't they? But she lived up to the billing. Fabulously glamorous and charming and sophisticated. Ah, what a star she was. Either that voice isn't put on, or she put it on specially just for me. And I went back to the office, and I was saying to some of my mates this. Oh, she was really, really nice. And a week later, my boss calls me to the office. I've had a letter, and it was from her, saying, congratulating him on how really nice and helpful and considerate I was. Because people just don't do that. If you ever get a letter, you can guarantee it'll be a letter of complaint. And he said, what are you doing being nice to people? Anyway, very lovely lady. We've also lost, of course,
the Thal Spy Ronson.
No, thanks to the...
The Thal Spy Ronson.
What, James Garbutt?
Yeah, died yesterday, age 95.
Oh, he didn't. Oh, no.
Yeah. That's who I thought... That's genuinely... I thought I was setting you up with the line then, with Davros' line. You didn't know that. Yeah, he passed away.
I didn't realise.
Yesterday.
Also, Ben, better known to those of us who've watched When the Boat comes in, as the sort of patriarch of the family. Lord, I didn't know that. Mm. No, I was going to say Tim Brooke Taylor.
Oh, yeah.
Mm. I was having a little chat with Hayden the other week about Monty Python books. Mm. I've just read Graham Chapman's autobiography.
Oh, yes,
of course,
yeah.
They worked together, didn't they, on Last the 1948 Show.
Yes,
and,
yeah.
And I think they were together, they went to, according to Graham Chapman's book, they went to Ibiza together with a load of other writers to start writing the script for The Rise and Rise of Michael Rimmer, which starred Peter Cook. And they're in this restaurant, and Graham Chapman goes into the toilet at this restaurant, and they've got this weird soap thing on a prong sticking up by the sink for you to wash your hands with, and it looked rather like a phallus, and this amused Graham Chapman no end, and he comes out of the toilet chuckling to himself and goes up to Tim Brooke Taylor and says, oh Tim, you really must go in the toilet and have a little look in there. I think you'll find it rather amusing. So Tim Brooke Taylor goes off, comes back out ashen faced, looking at Graham Chapman in disgust, saying, really, Graham, I think that's in rather poor taste. So Graham gets up to go and see what Tim Brooke Taylor's looking at, thinking, well, it's only a soapy phallus. Unfortunately, there was a man who'd had some sort of accident in the toilet and had fallen and split his head open. And there was blood everywhere. And so... Tim Brooke Taylor had gone in there thinking, and Graham hadn't seen it. Tim Brooke Taylor went in there thinking, oh, this is a big fun. Oh, there's a man lying there bleeding. And he comes back out, and there's Graham still grinning and laughing at him, going, it's funny, isn't it?
There's another story of the Kit and Kong episode of The Goodies when he takes the kitten out for a walk. Anakin starts dragging him around the place. Well, at the points where he's been dragged along the floor, they kept having to do like stop motion. So they were basically locking off the camera, one shot, then he moved up a bit, one shot, one shot, one shot. And during this period, he realized that that he was getting closer and closer and closer to a pile of dog poo, which was lying right in the line of him. But for continuity purposes, they said, well, we can't move it now. So he had to basically continue this very slow trajectory towards this mound of poo, and then basically lie on it for a bit, and then move up a bit, smudged all down his Union Jack vest and everything. And, yeah. Just another toilet-related incident with Tim Brooke Taylor there. You know.
Not another one.
Did you see that thing that was going on around social media of him? Because he was probably more famous towards the end for I Haven't a Clue, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He's on the One Show singing Girlfriend in a Coma to the tune of Tiptoes to the Tulips. It was quite...
I'll have to look that up.
Girlfriend in a coma, I know, that is serious. So girlfriend in a coma, I know, it's really serious. There were times when I could have murdered her, but you know, I'd hate anything to happen to her. Do you really think she'll pull through?
And then yesterday we lost Pip Baker.
Yeah.
Didn't we?
Oh, really?
Yes. And I hope this doesn't sound too crass, but finally.
Sorry, I thought you were going to leave it there.
Oh, God.
Excuse me. That wasn't. I hope this doesn't sound too crass,
but finally,
it was. I hope this doesn't sound too crass, but finally, in commenting on the Chris Chibnall era, we can at last say Pip and Jane Baker must be turning in their graves.
Bloody hell.
Wrote, of course, contributed to Mark of the Rani. What was it? The two final stories of Trial of a Time Lord.
Mm-hmm. Wasn't it Vervoids and Time Inc., wasn't it? Yeah, the last two.
Yeah, yeah. I didn't know they'd written the Meet Your Own Adventure with Doctor Who book.
Oh, I used to like them.
Well, there were several, though, wasn't there?
They used to have an Indiana Jones one. They didn't write that one as well, did they?
I've got one of the Colin Baker ones.
No, but is that one of the things where you... It says, if you choose this, do this.
Yes.
You turn to paragraph 39, yeah. If you want to go west, turn to paragraph 107.
Right. What else has been happening? Our former colleague, the Rev, also known as Andy, has been doing stuff. Those of you who remember far enough back to February 2014... And our fifth podcast, remember the Six Ages of Fan, where the Rev, Al Noh, and I sat in the Cloven Hoof in Devil's End, picking apart all aspects of fandom.
Oh, is this the Six Ages of Fandom?
That's it. For which the Rev, who one of his great roles in the podcast in those days was providing some extraordinary artwork to accompany the podcast. He actually painted six watercolours of the Six Ages of Fan.
Oh, I remember those. They were lovely.
Mm.
Showing a fan in childhood, teenage years, being at college, being etc., etc. And what the Rev has been doing, he's making available prints of the six, effectively I suppose you call them watercoloured cartoons, for charity during the lockdown for the Trussell Trust, which is a trust that supports a nationwide network of food banks, providing emergency food and supports people locked in poverty, and who campaign for the trying to end the need for food banks in the UK. I think during the current pandemic lockdown, they've been working to ensure the safety of everyone who visits a food bank. And and I saw this from the Rev on Facebook a few days ago, which I'll quote verbatim. A few years ago, I used to work on the popular Doctor Who podcast, Diddly Dum.
Is that the same one as ours?
Popular? It must only be someone else. Anyway, to get to the point, he's selling quality A3 prints of the cartoons in aid of the Trussell Trust. The minimum price is a fiver, which includes postage and that. So, and I myself bunged in a bit more than that. Not so much out of my generosity, and more out of the fact he knows me. If you came across it and said, he's only spent a fiver, the main thing. And this morning, it arrived in the post.
Aww.
In a nice compact, one of those cardboard tubes that you send posters in. And the Rev had drawn on the address label. He'd done a little sketch of me in my... those of you who are familiar with one of my avatars on social media will have seen me with a cardboard box over my head, which goes back to the very early days of Diddly Dum. That was originally painted by the Rev. So he's drawn me in one of those, and he's described it as my personal protective equipment. So, if anyone would like to partake of those, and or just contribute to the Trussell Trust, all the links are in our show notes on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com. Best thing you can do, really, is just find him at Scaro Media on Twitter. That's SKAROMEDIA. Something else that Andy or the Rev is involved in, apart from his charity work, which of course he doesn't like to talk about, which is why he gets us to talk about it. And I've noticed he's also got involved in a lockdown music performance thing where people can watch and hear some talented musicians and him doing some performances. You'll be able to find some of the Rev's songs, for which he was notorious in his Diddly Dum days. I seem to remember he had a Green Death song and a Sarah Jane song. You just pop over to the Captain Corona's Isolation Open Mic group, that chips off the tongue, on Facebook. Links in the show notes, as ever. Now, this coming Saturday, the 25th of April, we were, of course, supposed to be attending the Capital 5 convention weekend. Yeah. But like so much else in our lives during the lockdown, this hasn't happened. And you may recall that on our last podcast, Tony Jordan came on to explain how the Doctor Who Appreciation Society actually goes about postponing a fully booked convention from April until October. Now, in a bit which wasn't in the final version of that podcast, but which we may one day release as Diddly Dum 131.
Diddly Dum 131. The director's cut.
Oh, I really shouldn't have done that.
Lordy.
Let me have a sip of tea.
Now he's going to be talking like this for the rest of the podcast.
Mark asked Tony if there was any possibility of the panels from previous Capital conventions being put onto YouTube as a consolation for the fans during the lockdown. Because many of the panel interviews at Capital are filmed, partly as a historical record and partly so that the organisers, who are usually busy elsewhere at the time, can get to see them later. And Tony told Mark, oh, that is a very good idea. Mm. And now it's going to happen.
I was surprised that I had one.
And Tony's a man who, like Bruce Forsyth, plays his cards very close to his chest. And we don't know whether he was actually inspired by Mark or whether the Dwas was planning to do it all along, but on the back of the programme that the Dwas has produced for this, the credits read, and I quote, brought to you by Robbie Dunlop, Dave Greenham, Mark John, Tony Jordan, Peter Sims and Barry Ward, with thanks to Keith Barnfather and Thomas Jedski. Now, you see that? Robbie Dunlop, Dave Greenham, Mark John, Tony Jordan. They've clearly ordered those people in order of importance, haven't they?
Mm.
So draw your own conclusions from that, ladies and gentlemen. The Diddly Dum podcast, bringing you Doctor Who joy at all times. And so, on Saturday the 25th of April, starting at 10 a.m., when we were expecting to be strolling into the dealer's room at Capital 5, the Society's YouTube channel, which is Dwas Online, as well as on Facebook and Instagram video, will begin showing a selection of filmed panels from the first 4 years of the Capital Convention. Now, I think when guests appear on these panels, the Dwas gives them an undertaking that any recordings of the panels will remain private. Because I think there's a difference between chatting to a room full of people, dropping little anecdotes that haven't been heard before, and doing that to the whole world and his wife on YouTube. But the guests on these panels have generously given their permission for the Dwas, and I quote from the programme, to screen the footage in these unique times as we battle against the invisible enemy. Now, I know some of you will be thinking, but Mark, Hayden and Doc brought these panels to such vivid light for us with their own descriptions of being at these conventions that the real thing could only be a disappointment by comparison. A bit like reading the Target novelisation of Horns of Nymon and then seeing it on TV.
Yeah.
But we would urge you to give it a go. So let's have a look at the programme. So, panel one, they've got 20 years of the telemovie featuring Daphne Ashbrook and Gigi So. Panel two is The Power of Ones featuring Stephen Berkoff from last year, which was pretty extraordinary, wasn't it, Mark?
Yes, it was. Very interesting.
That's the panel where instead of sitting down and saying, so what was it like meeting Matt Smith on The Power of Three, Stephen? Tony Jordan sat down and started quizzing him about his views on Shakespeare and Beverly Hills Cop, wasn't it? It was a genuinely fascinating interview. And we recommend you all to see it if you can. Very, very good. Panel three is Once Upon a Space and Time with Sean Knopp, John Moreno and... Now, are you sitting down, Hayden?
I am indeed.
Shane Rimmer. Was that the panel where John Moreno told his story about being conscripted into the French army against his will?
Oh.
May well have been. And Shane Rimmer contradicted the official story of how Peter Sellers broke his leg on Dr. Strangelove. I think we missed that panel, didn't we? Because we were busy interviewing Annika Wills. Panel four was The Nut Hutch, featuring Stuart Bevan and Katie Manning. I think that's the one where you tune in to watch Katie almost falling backward off the stage.
Oh, that was a really good panel. That was we watched that with Polly, didn't we?
That was a good one, wasn't it? Yeah. Nearly falls backwards off the stage as a replica full-size maggot is produced from underneath the table.
A full-size Green of Death-style maggot, by the way, not yeah. just a normal life.
Stuart Bevan, of course, being Professor Cliff Jones. And Katie Manning, I don't know who she is. Is she
Elizabeth Shaw, wasn't it?
Not familiar with. Panel five is hang on. Are you sitting down again, Hayden?
Oh yeah.
Panel five is Highly Impressionable, featuring John Culshaw and Terence Dix.
John Culshaw?
No, I don't know him either, really. Which as you may remember, had Hayden and Sophie not been moving house at that weekend, Hayden would have been chairing.
Yep.
And then panel six. Oh, we were talking. I was talking about Honor Blackman looking so just like an incredibly elegant and sophisticated film star. Panel six, Leela of the 17, featuring Louise Jameson. So Mark and I were in a queue for her. Was that last year, Mark?
Yes, it was.
Yes, it was, wasn't it, for her autograph? Oh, so glamorous. So, the charities that the Dwas are looking to support as part of this event are NHS Charities Together. That's www.nhscharitiestogether.co.uk. And Domestic Abuse Volunteer Support Services, which is www.davss.org.uk. As Pip and Jane Baker may well have said, two very worthy and apposite causes at this time. And if you're able to donate any money while you're watching these videos, it will be gratefully received. Links to all these in the show notes, of course. And I think it's going under the name of, you'll find it on Twitter at hashtag contact has been made. Con convention. So it starts at 10 o'clock on Saturday the 25th of April.
British summertime.
We'll be there. Well, we won't be there, but we'll be there in spirit. Talking of plugging things for the Dwas, we've received a communication from none other than the Dwas coordinator himself, Mr. Paul Winter.
As my will, so mote it be.
What a Faustian pact that turned out to be when we agreed to become the Dwas Capital Convention's official podcast. Plugging the TARDIS. And this is... The Doctor Who Appreciation Society announces the return of TARDIS magazine. Now, were you familiar with this, Hayden?
No, I wasn't, actually. Well, actually, it was... Little extracts were in the television companion that David J. Howe, Stammers and Stephen James Walker released in the late 90s, but I didn't really know what it was.
It's the original fanzine, isn't it, that they brought out when they started up?
Well done, Mark. Oh, I see. First published in 1960, I think it predates the Dwas, actually. First published in 75, and when the Dwas was founded in 1976, they took over publication of it. Starting off as a hand-duplicated title, I don't know if that means that they use one of those little John Bull printing sets, or perhaps a letter set thing, yes, where you click all the things out. Later on becoming crowning photo pages and becoming professionally printed. Blah, 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 blah. Oh, I see. It was supplied as an addition to Dwas membership until it got gradually absorbed into Celestial Toy Room, which is the Dwas' own newsletter in round about 1987. Still predating Hayden.
Mm-hmm. Afraid so, people. Afraid so.
Between 97 and 98, Dwas resurrected TARDIS as a quarterly publication, but then retired the title again. Anyway, I think the way they phrase it is, whereas fandoms is a very virtual online experience these days, we remain convinced that there's a solid, sustainable demand for printed magazines produced by fans for fans. As such, the Dwas is very pleased to announce the return of TARDIS. So volume 16 will begin publication this summer under the editorship of Robbie Dunlop. Do we know him?
Robbie, was he the chap who was doing social media interviews at the Capitol?
The first Capitol we went to.
Yeah, he was Robbie, wasn't he?
Yeah, I think
That's Robbie Dunlop, yeah.
It will be an entirely commissioned features-based magazine, published three times a year, and available to all fans from Dwas's Space Rocket Limited, with discounts for Dwas members. Hooray! Dwas hopes to continue its tradition of supporting charities, with each edition raising funds for a worthy cause. Further details to be announced in the near future. Watch this empty space that circles time. Yeah, on the Diddly Dumb podcast, we will relay things to you. We have some old front covers of the TARDIS, which we will pop into our Tumblr page. Anything else been happening, chaps? Mark thinks he's almost worn out his Skype connection. So what have you been up to with your games nights, Mark?
Well, I've been doing online zombie shooting Left Dead 2 with some friends, which we haven't played since... I noticed that the last time I'd played it was 2014, so it's quite a blast from the past for us to go back to that. Oh, and also we've managed to set up a way of playing board games over Skype using a program called Tabletop Simulator, and it's good. Me and my flatmate and three of my other friends could all get together on Skype, and we play Carcassonne. I don't know if you've played that. It's like a city and road building tile laying game. It's very good. I highly recommend it. Very simple rules. We've been playing that. And there's loads of other games on there as well. Game of Life, even. I suspect they've got a Monopoly on there if you want to fork out for that. So yes, that's what we've been doing, playing board games over Skype. They haven't got War of the Daleks on there, unfortunately. But I don't think it'd be quite the same without the actual plastic Daleks knocking your figure over.
Yes, we've we have been trying to play Scrabble over Skype, haven't we? But Amazingly, Hayden's been winning every game, haven't you? He just seems to find those exact letter tiles that he needs at the exact right moment. It's been amazing.
It's just the jamminess.
If that's one of these times, Mark, we should suggest that we switch on the video function during one of these Scrabble games. Hayden, what have you been up to?
Well, this will lead in very neatly, actually, to what we're going to be talking about this episode. But yeah, like many of us, I've working from home at the moment and obviously isolating like we all should be right now. And we've had an awful lot of access issues at work. So there seems to be sort of peak periods where the systems go down and then we're left not being able to do anything. So I decided to watch some old Tom Baker. I say old Tom Baker as opposed to new Tom Baker stories. I started watching episodes and stories which I haven't really watched much. And what I'm really getting at here is sort of the later run, or that sort of middle to late period of Tom, which is more commonly known as the Graham Williams era, which faithless listeners will remember I'm not a big fan of. It's an era of the show which I came to fairly late on. Grew up watching a lot of the videos of the Robert Holmes and Philip Hinchcliffe stuff, and a couple of, well, and the East Space trilogy, basically. With that was it for Tom Baker for me growing up. And I thought, well, I'll give these a go, because they can't be as bad as all that. And I eased myself in with the story which we voted the best Tom Baker story of all time, several episodes back, and that was City of Death. And then managed to watch the whole of season 17 in the space of a week, and now I've moved on to the Key to Time season. So I'm sort of working my way back. But they're all a bit sporadic. I'm sort of, you know, watching them all out of order and story-wise, obviously not episodes. That would be incredibly difficult to focus upon.
Trout of a Time Lord, it's all over the place.
Yeah, so I've had quite a lot of time on my hands. So I watched season 17 in a week, just one story a day.
What a treat.
Well, we'll get to that, young Mark. We'll get to that. But, yeah, and one of the stories which I watched... You know when Doc is about to review a Jodie Whittaker episode and does that breath, that sharp exhale of breath? I'm just going to try and replicate that. I've been watching The Horns of Nymon.
Oh, sweet, sweet, sweet Nymon. How do I love thee? Let me count the ways.
I mean, this is a story which Mark, my colleague Mark here, he voted second in his all-time favourite Tom Baker stories, at which point I very nearly...
Of course, yes he did.
...blocked his number on my phone and moved to another wing in the Hooseum.
I don't think I was the only person who voted it second.
I think Mark Cockrum did, didn't he, as well, actually, thinking yeah, about it. Yeah, it must be a nerdology thing then, I guess.
Well, it's just a Mark thing.
So this is the story that we're going to be looking at this time out. And
I'll stand by that. I'd say, still say there's only one better story.
Have you noticed, Doc, that Mark's voice has become more and more excitable the closer we've got? I mean, I'm genuinely concerned for whether our friendship is going to survive this episode. I don't want it to be ruined.
I can't imagine, though, that you haven't had some sort of Damascene conversion.
You should just do what I do, Hayden. I find it easier. Just don't make friends with him in the first place.
How should we do this, chaps? Did you want to go first, Mark, and enthuse about it, or... Did you want me to go in first? I think it might be better, episode-wise, and for the listeners, if you go first, personally.
Do you?
Yes.
Okay.
Let's see. Out of Tom's 40-odd stories... I don't believe it! Oh, no, that's Talons.
Oh, you had me going.
Oh, it came, actually, out of 42 stories, I think, it came 18th, which isn't bad, I suppose.
Okay, girl.
Mark pretty in second place. Our Mark, Mr. Cochran, the human palindrome, and P. Waring on Twitter put it in fourth place. Steed Styling on Twitter put it in third place.
These people need to be stopped.
These people are awesome. These are the best people. Saltly Earth.
I can just imagine all of you getting together for a Horns of Nymon convention and walking around darkened corridors going, Lord Nymon, to one another.
Mark, would you like to explain to us why you love Horns of Nymon? Take your time.
I think I'll lie down. Hang on a minute.
Horns of Nymon, which finished in Doctor Who Magazine's 2009 Mighty 200 survey. Do you know where Horns of Nymon placed? Out of 200, obviously.
170th.
23rd.
23rd!
Lower!
Yeah. Well, I'm thinking of it is that Mark wouldn't... If a story he really loved had appeared really, really low in the rankings, he wouldn't be telling us, would he?
No, I'm afraid I am. It finished a shocking 189th.
200!
Only 11 stories were considered worse at that point in Doctor Who's history, which is an absolute travesty, and I'm never buying that rag ever again.
And they say democracy doesn't work.
Anyway, I just wanted to get that out of the way. It's been needling me since I discovered that, and I just wanted to get that out of the way. Yeah, Horns of Nymon is just, I think it's just the most fun Doctor Who story that I've ever seen. I don't think there's any... Honestly, I tried to think what stories are quite as much fun as the Horns of Nymon.
I can think of 188 more fun stories.
Oh, come on. This is... I mean, some people might see this as weakness, but I see this as strength. But Horns of Nymon is most certainly the Doctor Who story, especially the classic era, that is the most suitable one that you could actually go and watch on stage. Don't you think? It would just be... It's almost produced as if it is a stage production. And I don't just mean in the lazy sort of pantomime way, but at the end of the part two cliffhanger, I wanted to stand up and applaud and go and buy ice cream in the interval. I loved it. I've had such a lovely afternoon rewatching it. I've been laughing my head off.
Figuratively.
But it's not laughing at it either, before you suggest that. It's laughing with it. Because I think it's... Those performances are people who are really enjoying themselves. This is a story that's been shot with Graham Williams' budget quickly running out. Inflation, famously, on the rise week after week. So corners had to be cut. And I think, considering the circumstances, to get anything that looks anywhere near this good on screen, consider that Sharla didn't make it because of the strike afterwards as well. So it could have narrowly been... If they'd have changed the filming order around, you could have had Sharla instead of Horns of Nymon. I don't mean to upset you, Hayden. Is anyone still there?
Yeah, I'm just damning you with silence.
Just
that's all.
Stunned. Stunned silence. I just think this story's totally unfairly maligned. I mean, the script, I think, is particularly good. It's not written as a funny script. Admittedly, it's delivered as a funny script. But I think that's probably down to the fact that you've got Kenny McBain is the director on it. And this is the only Doctor Who he's done. He's better known for his Inspector Morse episodes that he produced.
Yes.
And the story before this was The Nightmare of Eden, where Tom famously fell out with... Oh, hold on.
If it was that era, just pick any name at random.
Oh, it's Alan Bromley, wasn't it? Nightmare of Eden, Alan Bromley fell out with Tom Baker because Tom was getting harder and harder to control, and Alan Bromley ended up walking off set and Graham Williams had to finish the series. So I think
I wasn't aware of that.
When it came to The Horns of Nymon, I think Kenny McBain, as someone who hadn't ever done a Doctor Who before, and considering this was his first time out with Tom Baker, I think perhaps he took a slightly hands-off approach to Tom. And I think there's a lot of stuff that Tom's obviously worked out in rehearsals, as he often liked to do, bits that made him laugh and kept him entertained. And I think they've kept them in. And I can appreciate that for some people, that's terrible. I mean, this... Era is criticised a lot of the time, isn't it, for Tom being too domineering and taking too many liberties with scripts.
Mm.
But I think it works for the 9-1's benefit. Certainly you've got the performances of Graham Crowden, which aren't going to be to everyone's taste, which I can understand. But they seem to be off the leash somewhat, these actors. And I think Graham Crowden off the leash, and possibly on the lash, is absolutely wonderful. His performance is just so eye-catching, mesmeric, and you can't take your eyes off him when he's on screen. And he's charismatic, and it's fun. And maybe it is a little bit overblown, but I think it suits the character. And I think besides Tom and Graham Crowden, I think the rest of the cast play it very straight. Lala's brilliant in it, and I think her scenes with Tom are superb. You've got Simon Gyps Kent, the young guy who plays Seth. And I think he's lovely in this. I think he plays it exactly right. Slightly wet, a reluctant hero who's been thrust into this position of being this...
I thought you were saying thrust into that pair of yellow wellies.
Thrust into those curtains and yellow wellies. And I think he does a great job. Janet Ennis is the overzealous, moon-eyed...
Love-struck.
Yeah, sort of love-struck fan of Seth. I think she plays it brilliantly as well. And as I said before about the stage thing, you've got these amazing costumes by June Hudson. And I think this is... I love June Hudson's designs anyway. And some of her work here is fantastic. Sorak's outfit, Sol Deed's second in command, is just...
It is glorious, isn't it?
Astounding. When you see him and he's flanked by the guards as well, with their plumes and their hats with the insignia on, with the 9-1 insignia, just looks glorious. It looks like a really decadent, over-the-top empire. Nearly every story I ever read about the costumes, they seem to use something called, is it cigarette quilting? Is that right? On the costumes. And there's clearly lots of that here. I'm not entirely sure what cigarette quilting is. Are you just Googling it?
Yeah.
Because I seem to remember reading about it in Robots of Death and stuff like that as well. Whenever I read an archive article, they always mention these.
During the late 19th century, most men enjoyed a good cigar. Because many cigars were made and sold locally, there were cigar manufacturers everywhere. Everywhere? What, in Wigan? This cigar was rolled on the inside thigh of a young Wigan girl. I thought it was a bit wrinkly. With thousands of brands to choose from, there was keen competition to establish each name as the best. Cigars were often sold in bundles wrapped by a silk ribbon with the brand name printed on it. These ribbons served not only the practical purpose of packaging the cigars, but also as a way to attract buyers. Blah, 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 blah. Collectors even traded ribbons with others to obtain a varied collection. Women found that a great way to show off a ribbon collection was to make a pillow, tablecloth, or even a quilt out of the ribbons they had collected.
Oh.
To create these decorative items, cigar ribbons were often stitched onto a muslin backing and on the sleeves of scone and army officers. I suspect that they didn't actually do that for Doctor Who, but it was that's where the name came from.
Oh, yeah, I'm not sure.
Ah, here's the cigarettes thing. Crazy patchwork became extremely popular and was advertised widely in magazines and journals. Even cigarette companies joined in with the obsession by introducing cigarette silks in packets of cigarettes. These small embroidered or printed silk pictures of flowers, butterflies, animals, flags and queens were used by ladies in their quilts, and they are still sought after today and swapped by aspiring crazy quilters.
Well, I'd say so. You've got Sorak, but Sorak looks incredible. Sol Deed, I think his outfit looks glorious. Apparently, it's just made. Hayden's going to say he's not surprised, but it apparently is made out of incredibly cheap material, pretty much the cheapest they could find. And I think it looks absolutely majestic.
I think they said it's some kind of silk on top of foam.
Yeah, it's like a cheap foam sari. Rubber, maybe.
Yeah. I think it looks absolutely glorious.
Mm, I do.
I think it's possibly one of the best things about the whole story.
oh, but
Sorak's sleeves.
Oh, just his sleeves and shoulders, yeah.
The war, what was Landa Ward calling the walking Sydney Opera House?
Yes, oh, and Lala Ward's costume in this. I know it's probably seems inappropriate in this day and age to have the companion dressed up as a fox hunter, but that outfit on her does look amazing. Apparently she chose it because she wanted a red outfit that would incite the Nymon as a bull.
Of course, yes, it's kind of a sense, actually, yeah.
So she looks fantastic. The Anethans look faintly ridiculous when you see that they're basically wearing curtain material. But, you know, it's all part of the fun. And I just think, like I said before, for the money they had, even the sets, I don't think look too bad. Some of the sets inside the power complex, I think, look pretty impressive. Especially ones of the larder, where they've got the people in the plastic shells.
Hmm. That's very Ark in Space, isn't it?
Yeah. Now, the Nymon, oh, a strange thing.
You can say that again.
I still think they look great because I don't know what they've done to... Well, I do know what they've done. They bought some type of material that when stretched looks like a sweaty, leathery material, which she's used for the face so that it looks more like actual bull skin. And those heads are supposed to be helmets. I said bull skin.
Sorry, right, okay. Sorry.
One of those times when a northern accent is an advantage. What was that line in Frasier? Where Niles is saying his wife's got her book club round.
Oh, hello, Dr. Crane. Will you be joining us for dinner?
If it's not too much trouble, it's Maris's night to host her book club, and they're more comfortable not having a man there. I sat in on the last discussion, and Mrs. Estabrook Kindred developed a facial tic every time she had to say the word Balzac.
How did we get onto that? Oh, bull skin, you say.
And I know they look weird and they move weird, but for me, that's all part of the charm. I mean, the fact that this episode looks so different, that is all part of the charm, the fact that the costumes are so outlandish. Because it's very easy just to have people in vaguely futuristic clothes or vaguely unusual clothes. Mm. But to go this far is wonderful. And even Cezon in his tattered version of Soldeed's clothes.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, fabulous. I mean, I know there's some strange production choices. Like, I mean, what they've done with the TARDIS console room isn't great. They've got one of the walls backwards, so the round doors are the wrong way round, and they're absolutely covered in muck. But then that sort of suits the whole narrative of the TARDIS being knackered and the Doctor having to stop it in the middle of nowhere and try and do work on it. And even then there's that bit where they put that sound effect over the console exploding, I think it's called
what, the boing at the end of it?
Yeah, it's from the games, isn't
the
it?
The spring's going boing, yeah.
Yeah, oh yes, it's Major Bloodnock's stomach sound effects from the Goon Show.
Oh, it's not, is it? Is it the same?
Yes.
Oh, for God's sakes.
Major Bloodnock!
How dare you call me Major Bloodnock?
That's your name.
In that case, I forgive you.
Now, that's interesting, isn't it? Because the sound guy on this, Dick Mills, worked on the Goon Show, didn't he?
Oh.
Apparently.
Right. I didn't know that bit.
Someone's been watching the information subtitles on during the commentary.
Oh, right. Oh, that's a lot to take in all at once. Commentary and information subtitles. I mean, all that stuff in the title's a bit weird. It's quite odd that they choose to do that cliffhanger when they do, the first episode one cliffhanger, where the Doctor suddenly clutches K-9 in fear.
Oh, that is very silly, yeah.
That lets it down. Oh, can I just say, my favourite bit of Tom Baker's performance in this is when he goes up to the Nymon capsule and he pulls out a spoon. And he taps the capsule with the spoon and then puts the spoon in his mouth and tastes it.
I missed that.
Mm.
It's just a really weird little thing that I don't think I've noticed before. And just if to see what the capsule's made of or where it's been or something, just gets his spoon out, taps it on the capsule, pops it in his mouth, has a little taste, thinks for a minute And then when he tells Romana to go and investigate the capsule some more, she grabs the spoon off him.
Is that the source of, you know, was it Matt Smith who was doing all the stuff like, you know, he returns to Amelia's house when Amy's all grown up.
Mm.
And he says, oh, why have you changed your greenhouse? And he licks it and says, oh, it's 20 years old or something. Ah, no, that's interesting, that. But however, if it's the original inspiration for the spoon fight in Robot of Sherwood, I'll never forgive it.
No, it's definitely not that. But I think your enjoyment of this story does depend on how much you like seeing Tom being let loose and just enjoying himself.
Mm.
And I know that for some people that's not to their taste. And for other people like me, it is.
So you like the idea of Tom being let loose, do you, Mark?
Yes.
So let's let loose Doc and Hayden, shall we?
Yes.
Hayden, heads or tails?
I will go tails, please, Doc.
It's heads. You've got to like it.
Oh, for God's sake.
No, it was tails, actually.
Do you want to go first or second?
I'd like you to go next, actually.
Second? Would you like to think about that?
Okay, I'll go first then, Brucey.
First, get it over with. Okay, Doc, off you go.
Right, well, I was, when you suggested we were going to do this, I was thinking that'll be easy. You know what, I've very rarely got anything but praise for Tom and his era. And I was thinking, oh yeah, admittedly I don't think I've watched this for years, but I was thinking, oh, that'll be interesting. And I'm afraid, because I've always taken this attitude that people who whinge about Tom becoming too silly in, shall we say, his post-Keter time era, which I think is roughly when people agree it starts happening, I've just thought, oh, really humourless people. The sort of fans who think the show is more important than it is. And so I was quite surprised to find myself watching this the last few days being put off by his performance.
Ooh.
I just couldn't. It doesn't help that he starts off with all that nonsense in the TARDIS. I don't like the chronic hysteresis stuff in Meglos either, where they're spending a whole episode and a half in the TARDIS messing around. I think that those bing-boing noises during the explosion sum it up. It's just, starting up to that wouldn't have been Tom's choice, but really? At one point I thought to myself, he's far too much Tom playing, quote, the Tom Baker Doctor, unquote. The stereotype of it. Things like the mouth-to-mouth resuscitation on K9 and the first prize rosette.
Oh,
which I would to bet were his ideas. And yes, not just the first prize rosette, but the camera actually zooms right in on it. And it just, I just find it very difficult to take it seriously. And it's interesting that during the commentary, they're talking about the need to play comedy with a straight face for it to work. One of the people who's most espousing that idea is Graham Crowden. And I think he goes too far. And it's been a long time since I've watched. This definitely isn't my favourite period of Tom's. So, for instance, with the exception of City of Death, season 17 is one of my least favourite of his seasons. City of Death is probably the only thing I really want to watch again. Nightmare of Eden, I can barely remember. The only thing I can remember, really, of Nightmare of Eden is the clip from the Tom Baker years tapes. And the bit at the end that I love, where he tells Louis Viandar to go away. Sharda, admittedly, you know, you tend to see that more often, perhaps, because people are constantly remaking it, because it never got made. And I was worrying during this, I didn't think I'd feel like this. Does this mean that once I start watching more Tom stories from this period, I'm going to start really getting put off by his silliness? And we've said this during Jodie's two seasons, haven't we? To what extent is stuff like this the director's fault? Shouldn't the director be putting a block on the actors, saying, no, come on, be serious? But if Alan, what's-his-name, did walk off the previous story, then maybe the director's either been told, be careful with Tom, or he's heard about it. He says, oh, I better be careful with Tom. I'm not messing things up for myself by getting into an argument with him. I don't know, really. But having said that, it must have been the director that allowed the boing noises during the thing. It must have been the director that allowed the camera to zoom in on that bloody first prize rosette. The episode one cliffhanger where the planetoid is spinning towards the TARDIS, and he grasps K-9 by the head. You think, oh, lordy. And I think with that sort of thing, it's very much suspension of disbelief with some areas of Doctor Who. It can be very easy just to not be bothered at all by the Nimon costumes. If you've started off, if you're really like Mark, you know, really enthusiastic about it from the start. You know, I don't care about how, you know, little money they've spent here or how ropey that design is. But if you start off, like I have, even though I have, the last two series of Doctor Who in these last 2 years with Jodie, I'm beginning to wonder whether I'm going in now expecting to dislike it, and therefore I'm noticing the annoying bits more than I would. Having said all that, and there's quite a lot of silliness, I mean, the fact that all the supporting cast who have no lines do nothing, the fact that the five Aneth tributes or sacrifices other than Seth and Tika say nothing and really don't really act throughout the whole of it. Same with all the guards and those that sort of council of guys dressed in black that Saltied keeps addressing and just keep punching the air occasionally.
On the kisses ring.
Yeah. Having said all that, I could easily, you know, if the first scene had been, what was the first scene?
Pilot and the co-pilot.
Yeah. If the first scene had been Sorak walking into Saldi's laboratory in those two costumes, and the two of them really chewing the scenery, I couldn't well imagine me feeling like Mark about this story. I'd start off thinking, oh, wow, look at that. Graham Crowden, far too over the top. One of the scenes of this that was in on the Tom Baker years tape that I remember most is the bit in the office where he's in the laboratory where he's saying, "You must, I'm the doctor." The doctor? Someone's digging a black hole on your door. Digging a black hole on my doorstep. Mm-hmm. I thought, I quite like that. And Tom says, oh, you see two old, you know, professionals there doing this thing where one actor repeats what the other one says and it works quite nicely. And I thought, oh, yes, it doesn't. Watching this last few years, I'm thinking, oh, no, actually, it looks a bit silly. But I could easily throw that away for the costumes. That's glorious operatic costumes, which seem to be, apart from Romana, entirely reserved for the Skonnen characters, because I think the Anethans get a very short short end of the stick, don't they, with the costumes. Sorak as the walking Sydney Opera House. Doesn't June Hudson actually say that his sleeves were based on that? And it's mad, but not silly. And Mark's right, if you look at those sleeves, they look gorgeous. Mm. It could well have been that within a year, in the BBC prop store, that was all falling to pieces. But it looks fabulous, and it looks actually quite... I will at length consider whether to delete this next word. It looks quite kinky.
Oh, yeah. Jane Hudson does do quite a lot of kinky, though, doesn't she?
Well, exactly. It made me think watching that.
Very Blake 7.
What was the Blake 7 convention called? At the Maximum Power Blake 7 convention in Stevenson. Mm. Last year, Margaret and I attended, June Hudson was on the stage, and she was talking about, what was that, that leather shop?
Is it Hardcore?
Leather fetish shop, Hardcore. Somewhere near Carnaby Street she used to go to get ideas.
The King's Road.
And she used to talk about these leather costumes worn by these mannequins in the windows. And what did she say about things missing, Mark?
With pieces of material missing from the most unfortunate places.
Yeah, those unfortunate places. And I thought, oh, I bet she's thinking of this here. That does look lovely.
It's that kind of decaying decadence.
Yes, exactly. I was reading when Terence Dix, who else, novelised this. He did, as they often did in those days, a prologue where he's describing how the Skonnen Empire sort of rose and then fell because of a civil war, and how the remnants that were left ended up like that. And he was saying, you know, it's just a few very well-protected elites and a handful of guards who survived. And that looks like that, doesn't it? It looks like a decadent civilization where that's... Actually, those costumes like that are pretty much all they've got left of their glory. Wasn't he offered the Fourth Doctor role, Graham Crowd?
Yes, he was, yeah. He turned it down because of fear of typecasting, I believe.
But I do think that he and Tom are provoking each other, if you know what I mean.
Yes, definitely.
to more and more overact, and it gets to the point where it goes beyond, you know, playing the comedy with a straight face.
Mm.
But having said that, Salty's has some great bits. The bit where he's the co-pilot tries to make excuses for while he's cut things up, and Salty clearly knows right from the start what's happened, and where he's questioning him.
Mm.
Oh yeah, how exactly did you mend the engines? That goes really well. That bit where he's talking to because I think it was one of his best bits in the whole story, where it shows a completely different side to his character. And you think mainly Salty's either a nutter or very, very gullible. And he still is, but there's that scene where he's talking to Sorok in his laboratory. He's talking about playing the Nyman on a long lead.
Salty, it sometimes occurs to me to wonder exactly why the Nyman is doing this for us. I mean, to be blunt, what's in it for him?
Sorok. You dare to question?
Oh, to speculate, Salty. Not to question, merely to speculate.
Sorok, you must understand the Nyman. The Nyman is as a god to us. It pleases him to be godlike, to receive tribute, and to grant us power. We want that power, so we give him the tribute he asks. Or rather, we get Anef to do it for us.
Something for nothing, in fact. That always makes me feel uneasy.
Sorak, you are too scrupulous. You get what you want by giving people what they want. If there happens to be a little imbalance, make sure it's in your favor. The Nyman is simple. Powerful, brutal, yes. Scientifically advanced, yes. But simple in his desires. I fawn to him a little. That satisfies his bestial ego, and he gives us what I ask. I play the Nyman on a long string.
And I like that. Mm. I would have enjoyed it a bit more if there'd been a bit little more of that, where Soldi's a little less of the grandstanding nutter.
I really enjoyed the grandstanding nutter, though, because that's where he's losing his mind at the end. I mean, the most over-the-top acting is part four. But he has been completely and utterly undone by Romana pointing out to him, how many Nyman have you seen today?
Yes. And
he completely unravels. And it is over the top.
She really is a meddlesome hussy, isn't she?
Yeah, I know. That's such a great line, isn't it? You meddlesome hussy. And he's saying, no, you have undone everything that I... And he blames it all on Romana. And that's one of the things I forgot to mention was this is a particularly great story for Romana because she does take care of business. She does
doesn't she?
Yeah, she absolutely does.
In fact, she departs from Tom completely, doesn't she, when she goes to Krynoth?
Yes.
Well, and she's messing around with Susan, whatever it's called.
Yeah, she spends a lot of the time separated from Tom in this, and it works well because she gets to do her own full-on proper lead Time Lord business. With her own sonic screwdriver that Lala Ward loved so much that she still has it to this day. And there's that, like you say, that final scene with Salty.
How many Nymons have you seen today? How many Nymons have you seen today? How many Nymons?
He said he was the only one.
How many Nymons?
He said he was the only one.
How many Nymons have you seen today?
Don't dare blaspheme the Nymon.
How many Nymons have you seen today?
Don't dare blaspheme the Nymon. You meddlesome hussy.
That was a clip that we borrowed from the YouTube account of Colo Sigma 1. And if you haven't heard it before, we really recommend that you go and have a look at that. Just go into YouTube and search for Doctor Who How Many Nymons Remix. And it's absolutely glorious. And a great way of showing Romana's agency in this story. And I wonder if that's why they dressed her like that. Because you know that sort of floaty dress she has in...
Yes, yeah.
Is that
Nightmare of Eden.
Yeah, or what's the other one?
Creature from the Pit.
Yeah. Maybe they're thinking, well, she's not got much to do. Let's just make her look pretty. Whereas actually, that very form-fitting hunting pink outfit she's got, which is slightly... A bit like in Destiny, where she's effectively wearing a feminized version of the Doctor's outfit, isn't she? It's a bit like that. And it makes her look authoritative.
Yes, it
to
does.
A degree.
It looks like a great, apart from the fox hunting connotation, it looks like a great Doctor costume, doesn't it, really?
Yes. I think I will skip over the Nymon costumes. That's exactly what Mark said. It would work well on stage. You know what I mean? Well, if you're in the back row of the gods, the Nymon costumes might look quite impressive.
Oh, yeah, because they're about 8 foot high, with the including horns and heels.
Mm. Horns and heels should definitely be the title for the podcast.
That has got to be the title of this episode.
Yeah, I like that.
Let's see, I've got anything particularly interesting to say before I pass it on to Bugalugs. and it's true that actually, as the Doctor starts working out what's going on, he does become more serious.
Mm.
Not serious enough for me to redeem the story, but perhaps enough.
See, I think when he's serious, he's very, very serious indeed. I mean, I think it's probably a story of extremes, and I think that's why, from everything, from the production to the costuming to the performances to the direction to the post-production choices, everything is a story of extremes with Haunts of Nymon, and I think that's why I love it.
Hayden, jump in.
Oh, someone is resuscitating.
So, you know what? I get it when people have things that make them feel very comforted, things that take them back to an age and an era that's long gone by, very happy times, all the rest of it. Mark, you were born in 72, 73, am I correct?
Well, I don't know if you really want to get exact on here, but yeah, 71.
71, okay, so you would have been 8.
Oh, rub it in, won't you?
You'd have been 8 when the Horns of Nymon went out, okay.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
Yeah, yeah.
When I was the same age, I had a present one year. I can't remember what. I don't think it was a Christmas present, but it was the Ice Warriors box set. And in that Ice Warriors box set had a video, which was called The Missing Years. It was a documentary. Listeners will be, they'll know it if they've owned that box set or the Lost in Time box set. You know, it's one with Fraser Hines and Debbie Watlin. At the end of that, they introduce an episode of Doctor Who, which at that point was the earliest surviving Troughton episode, and it was episode 3 of The Underwater Menace. Now, I really liked that, just that episode alone. And I, for years, didn't get why everyone thought The Underwater Menace was shit. When episode 2 came back, I enjoyed that even more. And even now, even through its faults, I can see The Underwater Menace for what it is. And that's a B-movie romp, basically, at the start of Troughton's era, with Ben and Polly and Jamie. So it's a TARDIS crew that, until recent times with the animations, we really don't get to see much and probably never will get to see. And it's Troughton having fun. Now, that in context with the Horns of Nymon. You've got Troughton having fun at the start of his era. Well, he's having fun because he's not getting on with the director and hates the story. And he's also trying to find a foothold in this new character that he'd only recently taken over. From William Hartnell, of course.
Sorry, who's he not getting on with? I didn't know that.
Oh, it was Julius Smith was the director of The Underwater Menace.
Right.
And she went on to be one of the first producers on EastEnders. She was one at the start of EastEnders.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Oh, she ended up in tears, didn't she, one day on the production of Underwater Menace, I think.
Yeah, because it was such a troubled production and Troughton hated it.
Was that the day they handed in the script?
Well, this is the thing. Okay, so Troughton at that point is having fun, but he's having fun because it's an appalling script, essentially, isn't it? I mean, like I said, I enjoy it for what it is, but I can see there are probably about 15 other Troughton stories which are better than it. But I enjoy it, and as a little bit of escapism, I can sink my teeth into The Underwater Menace. No troubles, even the Loose Cannon recreation. You know, one of the only ones I can watch. But here we've got Tom in his 6th year as the Doctor, and at this point, he's completely off the leash. He's not taking the role seriously at all anymore. He's doing it more for his own entertainment, I think, but he is at points not hamming it up as such, but dumbing down his Doctor, it feels like to me. Yeah. Now, Interesting point that you made earlier, Mark, with regards to Nyamon is the most likely Doctor Who story that you'd like to see on stage.
Mm.
Now, we on this podcast several times have decried Colin Baker's era for being too stagey, for the acting to be for being too big for television, for being too... It's not dialed down. You know what? I see an awful lot of similarities with season 17 that I do with the Colin Baker era. And all I really think separates them, genuinely, is the Doctor in this time. You know, and also the fact that there's obviously more humour in season 17. But the quality of story is on a par with the Colin Baker era. And by par, I actually mean the Trial of the Time Lord, I'd say, a little bit more than everything else. So if you were eight in 1986, you would probably love Trial of a Time Lord.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So...
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I'm very open about that.
Mm. So you were blessed as such to be 8 years old.
Or cursed, as you might think.
No, because it brings you enjoyment. And I'm not here to say, well, you're wrong for liking this. Of course not. I came to The Horns of Nyamon when I was 24. 23, 24 was the first time I saw this. So not long ago, I suppose. But it was, and I was writing it, I was writing about it for a Celestial Toy Room at the time. Mm. And I thought, I couldn't believe what I was seeing. I thought, this is tacky, this is badly acted, this is badly written, this is badly directed. This is 80s Who, 8 years earlier, or 7 years earlier, sorry. What is it?
Groundbreaking.
What is it? What is it about? Can you... Mark, you're going to break those straws if you clutch them any tighter.
Damn it, no. You have to pry these straws from my cold dead fingers.
Ooh, I wish I'd said that.
You will, Doc. You will.
I think there's a trend with the Graham Williams era where the stories at the start actually start off pretty solid, I'd say.
Yeah.
And then there's a downward trajectory towards the end of the series. It happens with his first series, after Image of the Fendal, I can't get on board with the Sunmakers at all. And from then on in. It happens with the Key to Time series. As soon as the Doctor slaps on a barrister's wig in front of the Megara in the Stones of Blood, that's the point where the Key to Time series, I'm lost to that as well.
Mm.
By the time that he's blowing off the creature in the pit, and the creature from the pit, I'm lost to series to season 17. I'm lost to that as well. The Horns of Nyamon is tripe. It's really bad.
Oh, it's not really tripe. Bad.
Now, this time round, there were a couple of things I found that redeemed it somewhat.
Yeah.
I think the subplot, well, I say the subplot, but with the two artificial black holes, when Romana meets, what was his name? It was Cizom. That's a brilliant idea and a concept that Doctor Who doesn't really explore very much, is going back somewhere after it's been defeated. That's a really interesting idea. What that's doing at the start of part three, after you've had the Doctor farting around in the TARDIS with a first prize rosette, the thing going boing and talking about what a brilliant slow bowler he'd have been, it's too little too late. You're right, Doc. Graham Crowden and Tom Baker seem to be in this overacting arc going on.
I thought you were going to point out something that you liked. So you seem to be carrying on pointing things out.
Sorry,
that you
well,
don't
there
mind.
We are. Okay, sorry. Yes. Seth and Tika, I found them quite endearing.
Yes.
And tried my best to not think of them as endearing just because Janet Ellis was one of them. You know, actually, I quite enjoyed their characters.
Blue Peter fanboy.
And I enjoy the fact that Romana seems to be the main character in this story as well. I think that's quite a nice deviation from the norm.
Mm.
From the norm. But I do think that... I think it's such a shame that this was sort of where Doctor Who was. Incredibly, at the time... Did you know this story almost doubled its audience between part one and part four? Which I couldn't quite... I did a little bit of research. Part 1 was seen by 6 million viewers. Part 4 was seen by 10.4 million viewers. I'm wondering whether there was just a power cut on ITV on the other side at the time. which there probably was, actually, thinking about it.
ITV was off during City of Death, wasn't it?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I'm not sure about that.
But tonally, this is sillier than some of the DWM strips of the day. I'd have much preferred to have seen the Iron Legion. Impossible as it would have been to have realised that on screen. That's a much better story than what you had coming out on telly at the same time. But that shouldn't be. You know, it's so weak. And I do wonder whether... And don't get me wrong, I absolutely adore the man and I do see him as an inspiration when it comes to writing, for me especially.
Anthony Reed.
Anthony bloody Reed. No, Douglas Adams was clearly... He hadn't been able to separate Hitchhikers and Doctor Who during his time. Cause this was he writing the second series of Hitchhikers?
Yes.
I think at this time, yeah, wasn't he? Yeah.
He basically took on this job and then got commissioned for more Hitchhikers.
That's it. They're bleeding into one. And that shouldn't happen. There should be two different entities. Doctor Who shouldn't be a sci-fi comedy. And yet it's trying to be a sci-fi comedy here.
I don't think, can I just say, I don't think there is that much comedy in the script. I mean, apart from the rather wonderful, and I'm not sure, it sounds like a Douglas Adams line.
Hmm.
The one about, that sounds like an insecure personality. And then Seth says, oh, he lives in the power complex. And Romana says, yes, that sounds about right. You know, apart from that, there's not that much comedy actually in the bare naked script, so to speak.
No, but it's a pantomime. It's an absolute pantomime. At some point, I keep thinking that Soul Deed is going to start throwing sweets out to the first few rows because he's hamming it up so much.
Yeah, which is why I said it would be so good on stage. But I adore that. I don't think any actor could do what Graham Crowder does. I don't think any actor could get away with it. But for me, an actor like Graham Crowder does get away with it. The only pantomimey bit, really, that I think is, I think it's the cliffhanger for episode 2 when Romana stood there with all the Anethans and the co-pilot, and then the 9-1 suddenly appears going, rawr, and everyone sort of scoops back a few steps and gasps in horror at the appearance of the 9-1. That is very pantomime.
And the co-pilot even splits his trousers.
What about the Lord Nymon? The Lord Nymon! You can be, he's behind you! You know, it's... And the boing on the TARDIS, and it's the first... I just think it's... It's sad, actually, because I think, you know, there's a lot of very, very good people involved in the show at this time. And it's just not, and whether that be through budget problems or the fact that you've had a Doctor who has clearly been there far too long at this point. I mean, I grew up, almost the same could be said for Doc here, but I grew up with a fourth Doctor who was very distant, very alien, and yet reassuring. And you knew at the end of the day he was going to sort the baddies out and everything would be right as rain by the end of it. With this version of the fourth Doctor, he's just dicking about. Even in the costume. It's literally, oh, I'll just wear a shirt and put this thing over the top and then my scarf is just all ragged. It's dishevelled. And Doctor Who, by this point, it's dishevelled. It really needed that freshen up. I know people obviously have their opinions about John Nathan Turner, but boy, did season 18 couldn't have come any sooner after this. God, did it need a refresh. It did need the fourth Doctor being put back in line again. Because he's just larking around for his own shits and giggles but at this point. It's not a fourth Doctor I recognise. It's not a fourth Doctor I... It's a comic book Doctor. You know, it's like, oh, the light-hearted what's going on in DWM this week kind of Doctor. It's not... It shouldn't have got to this stage, really. And I do wonder whether he had stayed on maybe a year too long at this point. You know, maybe this would have looked a little different with another Doctor, or maybe not. Maybe this Doctor is holding this stuff up as being just about bearable to watch.
Well, that's another way of looking at it, isn't it? Is it actually that he's getting bored with the scripts he's been given?
Mm.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, maybe bored with the direction he's getting. for instance, when you think he's gone from having what must have been a very, like in the Hinchcliffe Holmes era, a very agreeable director and script editor to work with, and he's got people like directors like David Maloney, who clearly he and Liz Sladen liked a lot.
Yeah, Douglas Camfield for Seeds of Doom. Yeah.
Maybe he's just not like he's just not enjoying the. Obviously, there's an element to which he's just gotten getting a bit too big for his boots. But
yes, definitely. But there's also the fact as well that, and we would have all have experienced this in our lives. When you're in a job for too long, you do become like this. You know, the first year or two is incredibly challenging. You're finding your feet. You're just trying to get your head down and do the best job you can. By about years 3 and 4, you're incredibly comfortable in your own skin there. You know your team inside and out. By maybe years 5, 6, and 7, you're kind of thinking, well, I can do this in my sleep now. There's not much of a challenge here. I've been here long enough that people respect me and maybe won't tell me to knuckle down as much anymore. That's exactly what happened with Tom Baker as the Doctor. And then as soon as someone with authority comes in again with season 18, he kicks against it and is like, no, I don't want to be here anymore because I'm not allowed to do what I did the last... because I was let off the chain for the last couple of years and now someone else is coming.
I don't know if it's just that season 17. I mean, he was famous for ad-libbing and making stuff up in rehearsals.
Hmm.
But usually people were strong enough, directors and indeed producers were usually strong enough to say no when it went too far. And that's, I think that's the thing, isn't it? Is that people have stopped saying no.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. They're facilitating him now.
Yeah. I mean, he has been there a long time. I'm not sure that means that he's necessarily bored. I think it means he's got quite proprietorial and he thinks he knows best.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so it's a matter of taste, I think, as to how much that affects your enjoyment of the story. I mean, yeah, I wouldn't like him to be like this all through his run because I love the contrasts. I love the early Hinchcliffe.
Mm.
As you said, his darkness and his otherness. Even in those early years, he's still got his warmth. And then it reaches its sort of peak of clowning around at this point in 79. And then, yes, it all becomes very dour and funereal in that last season. And I love all those different flavours and all those different... I love those different contrasts.
I think I probably came to these stories too late in the day for me to find the same things that you love in them. If I'd have had, Nightmare of Eden or Androids of Tara, let's say, on VHS as a kid, maybe I'd look at them in a different way now.
Yeah.
But this is a version of the Doctor that is so divorced from the one that I grew up with and the one that I really do see. I mean, it's City of Death is brilliant. It is brilliant. And actually, do you know what? On this rewatch, I found things in Nightmare of Eden that I actually quite liked.
Oh, Nightmare of Eden's cracker. Well, obviously, I would say that.
But, yeah, I was going to say.
Well, not obviously, but... It'll surprise you, Hayden, but I like Nightmare
of
Eden.
No, I quite enjoyed watching Nightmare of Eden. But there's elements of The Creature from the Pit and this, which is just bad sci-fi. You know, and I really cannot ignore the fact that around about this time, on the other side, stuff like Buck Rogers was taking off. You know, obviously you just had Star Wars. Doctor Who was competing in a new landscape, in a new science fiction landscape, you know. Which I know it.
Creature from the Pit. Can I just say, Creature from the Pit is really my sort of Achilles heel when it comes to season 17. There's stuff I really enjoy about that, and stuff I'm not so keen on.
I quite like the idea of the translator when you've got to put your hand on it, and then the creature talks through you. That's a good idea. Anyway, yeah. Sorry, no. You know, so I know Doctor Who couldn't compete with these things anymore, and I know, like you said, you know, there was inflation week on week and they really were struggling to put this together, and it's amazing they got anything out anyway, and it's brilliant that this is a loved era and this is a treasured time for Doctor Who fans as well, because the likes of DWM had started coming out and fandom, the Doctor Who Appreciation Society was, you know, gathering speed around this time as well. There was a real sense of, you know, there were things there for the fans. This was an established show. It was getting more viewers week on week than it had done for years, if not ever, during stuff like City of Death. I can understand why it's a magical time for fans. But for me, I just think it's not a patch. It is not a patch on a lot of Doctor Who from a lot of other eras, I have to say. But for Tom especially, it's disappointing to see that it, by this point, you know, it's just got so silly.
But, you see, for me, this, I mean, I've got early memories of, I mean, I think I've got a vague memory of even seeing Planet of the Spiders.
Wow.
Vague memories of Giant Robot and very specific memories from only patchy ones from Tom Baker's first season.
Mm.
So I was watching them, but it was really season 16, season 17, where I can remember every story.
Mm.
It really started settling into my consciousness.
Mm.
So this kind of was my Doctor.
That
excitement. I remember seeing stuff in the press about Destiny of the Daleks, the new series of Doctor Who going to start up and stuff. And it was just so incredibly exciting. And so I've always retained a bit of that nostalgia, I suppose.
Mm.
And so my love for this era is as blind as the Nymon is when it's walking around the power complex. You can't see people clearly hiding behind see-through panels.
Yeah. And that's the great thing about this show. You know, that's one of the reasons why we do what we do, why we've been podcasting for 6 years. It's because of, you can come to this show at different points in your life and you can love it for different things. You know, someone who was 10 back in 1965 will absolutely adore Galaxy 4 or, you know, The Mythmakers or something like that, while other people can completely dismiss it because they were older at the time or because obviously they've never seen or heard of it. When I was 10, I went to the BBC store at Broadcasting House because there was like a BBC Experience thing there and I was allowed to get a treat. So I bought Resurrection of the Daleks on VHS. When you're 10 years old, that's a fantastic story to watch because it's all, you know, everyone dies at the end of it apart from the Doctor and Turlough and Tegan and Lytton, of course.
Well, I probably was 10, wasn't I? Or just 11.
In 1999, I would have seen that, so I was 10. Oh, yeah, you'd have been about 13, I think, wouldn't you? 71.
74. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but you'd have been around about the similar age where, you know, seeing people blow up and, you know, Daleks being pushed out of warehouse buildings and exploding as soon as they hit the ground is cool and really great stuff to watch.
Yes.
But, of course, if you're watching that when you're 20 years old, you're thinking, Doctor Who got quite bloodlusty. You know, this is different now. And it was the same for all different eras. You can pick up different eras that other people aren't going to like and you can hold them close. You know, and that's absolutely fine. Of course it is. And that's fantastic and that's lovely. So I hope my criticism hasn't hurt you in any way, Mark.
No, not at all.
But for me, it's really weak.
See, my one, I would argue about that in general, though. I know that, yes, I've got this inbred love of this story and of this season and era in general. But for me, I can't agree that it's a bad story. For me, it's a good recipe. And maybe it's been made by a chef who you're not fond of. And maybe someone's thrown in a few extra ingredients that you don't normally like the flavour of. But I still think it's a good recipe. I can understand you not liking some of the over-flavoured acting, but
it's a bit like you're making an Angel Delight and then some comes along with paprika and then just empties the whole jar in the pot. Wearing a Graham Crowden mask. But anyway... Yeah, I completely understand what you mean, but I can...
My dreams of dessert!
I just think, you know, it's...
How many puddings have you had today?
Three! Oh, see. Like I said, there's bits to liking it, but not enough for me. This is, for me, that 189th position in the... What was it called? The Big 200, was it?
The Mighty 200.
The Mighty 200 is... That's roughly where it should be for me.
Oh. See, I do feel that's terribly harsh, but I can understand.
Hmm.
Mark seems so blinded by love that I bet he thinks that David Briley's brilliant as K-9.
Oh, no, I feel bad for Dave Briley, but you can never, you just can't beat John Leeson.
Yeah.
No.
What K-9 needs to sound is insufferably pleased with himself.
Yeah, it's not right.
He's the war K-9.
Affirmative, master.
No, it is. It's not right. I feel sorry for David Briley. I'm sure he's a lovely chap and fine actor, but you can't beat John Leeson. I will concede that.
Why did John Leeson not do season 17?
Maybe you have something else to do.
Oh, I did know this, but I can't remember it.
Did you see the script?
It's a faulty brain. No! Leave those scripts alone.
Did anyone listen to the commentary?
No.
And this is the only Tom Baker story I don't own on DVD as well, because I'd sold it to my mate.
Also, I think asking Hayden to listen to the commentary is probably pushing things a little bit too fast.
It's like Clockwork Orange, you're going to have to pin my ears back and, you know.
I've never listened to a commentary with Lola Ward on before.
Oh.
I've always deliberately avoided them on things like where she's just her and Tom's not on.
Mm.
I've always avoided the one on Leisure Hive as well, and she can be such a pitch.
Mm.
I mean, I don't know if it's her thing is that she makes cracks about how awful it was to have to work and live with Tom. Well, first of all, you were the one who married him, love, not us. But she says at one point, they say that Simon Gipps Kent or Gipps Kent as Seth is good, and she said, oh, wasn't he... I heard a rumour that he was one of the people that was considered for the role of Adric. And then she says...
He'd been a child star. I think he was in a lot of those Dickens adaptations on the BBC, wasn't he? And he'd done a lot. He was a very sweet boy.
I have a vague idea, but I could be wrong, that he was one of the actors considered for the part of Adric later on when we landed up with Matthew Waterlogged, or whatever he was called. Waterhouse, who, of course, was so wonderful in the part. And Simon really didn't stand a chance.
Oh.
Is that you cow? I mean, I think we fairly well know what she thinks. You don't say that sort of stuff on, do you?
Yep, they're encouraged to, probably, aren't they?
Especially when she's forever sucking up to Graham Crowden on the commentary. And it just comes across as really, really nasty. And it makes me feel that's why I didn't listen to it.
I wonder if that's a slight class thing. That she sort of looks down on people like Matthew Waterhouse, but looks up to people like Graham Crowden.
She's the Ronnie Barker in the lineup.
It makes me funny where she's. Well, you see these interviews with her where she's constantly going on about how immature Matthew Waterhouse was to work with, and this is one half of a couple who spent one season refusing to look each other in the eye on screen because they'd fallen out with each other.
And he had just turned 18, hadn't he, as well, when he started?
Yeah. I mean, he was fairly young.
History has made Matthew Waterhouse look a hell of a lot better. Not just as Adric, but actually as an individual within fandom.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
I wonder who his adult role models were in the acting world. Tom Baker and Lola
Ward.
Yeah.
And I had no idea until I watched Weekend with Waterhouse that he'd just lost his brother right about that time. It just comes across as, and it doesn't surprise me what...
Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out, here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud. He's got radioactive blood. Can he swing from a thread? Take a look overhead.
You think, oh, f*** off.
But,
actually, Janet Ellis, who I thought, oh, God. I want to listen to her. She was actually the best thing on that commentary. She's bright. Bright as in lively. Informed. She said a bit more about the show than the others did.
She'd be good on a magazine-style programme.
When you reach the point where Graham Crowden was lecturing us on how, with comedy, you've got to play it with a straight face.
Christ.
I look down on him because I am upper class. I look up to him because he is upper class. But I look down on him because he is lower class. I am middle class. I know my place. I look up to them both.
but I don't look up to him as much as I look up to him. Because he has got innate breeding.
I have got innate breeding, but I have not got any money. So sometimes I look up to him.
I still look up to him. Because although I have money, I am vulgar. But I'm not as vulgar as him. So I still look down on him. I know my place. I look up to them both. But while I am poor, I am industrious, honest, and trustworthy. Had I the inclination, I could look down on them. But I don't.
We all know our place, but what do we get out of it?
I get a feeling of superiority over them.
I get a feeling of inferiority from him. But a feeling of superiority over him. I get a pain in the back of my neck.
To be fair, apparently one of the scenes that gets most criticism is that final, is Graham Cram's death scene, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know whether it's true or not, but they do say that it's quite possible that he thought it was a camera rehearsal when he was doing it.
Yeah, they say that in the information subtitles, that they thought it was a rehearsal, and that's why they left it, at the end, they left in. They had to leave in as he sort of falls the floor.
Yeah, because they couldn't do another take, could they? That was the only one they'd got.
I've never really understood. I mean, they go on and on in the commentary about what a tragedy it was that they cut out this idea of Soldi's death speech, I've caught an everlasting cold. Mm. Watching that scene, I can't imagine how that would actually fit in and work.
Mm-hmm.
That's almost mildly tragic, that line, isn't it? You know, why am I ever going to say that?
Yeah.
We put in a line, I remember, from The White Devil at the death speech of Soldeed, which was, "I have caught an everlasting cold," which is from Webster's The White Devil. And Graham overplayed it, and Kenny McBain, I think, the director, insisted that we cut it, and I regretted it very much. It was a wonderful, wonderful moment. Very enjoyable, that one.
I was a little bit disappointed with Simon Kent, because not because I thought he was bad or anything, I just thought he was given so little to do. He was just running around corridors and that. He was quite a big figure on TV in my childhood. He was in, in the 70s, he was in a children's series called Thursday's Child.
I was in The Tomorrow People as well, wasn't he?
He was in The Tomorrow People. He had a big role in To Serve Them All My Days in the late 70s. I wonder about this time, actually, as a sort of elder schoolboy called Boyer, I think he was called, who sat one row back in the classroom from Matthew Waterhouse.
Oh,
is that the programme with Nicholas Lyndhurst in it as well? Was that one?
Yeah.
Right. I've seen bits of that.
As Simon Kent's sidekick. But that's one of the things they're clearly all, at least in their mid to late 20s, all these schoolboys who are playing 16-year-olds. But he's done so well that you're happy to ignore the fact. I mean, Nicholas Lyndhurst barely got any hair in it. He's really, really good in that. I think he dies about 10 years after this from a morphine overdose.
Who, Simon Chips Kent? Sometime in the mid-80s, wasn't it? 28, he was.
It's unfortunate that. Michael Osborne, who plays Sorak, he's got a brilliant moment where, yeah, I think in one of the final later episodes, he's in, talking to Soldi in his laboratory. Soldi sort of sweeps around to do a dramatic exit. You can see Michael Osborne sort of jerking his head back so that the edge of Soldi's giant collar doesn't rip one of his eyes out. And was Squadron Leader Bane in Secret Army, in Collaborator, which was the...
I'm trying to remember.
The sort of reveal story in Series 3.
Yes, okay.
And of course, it's all very much like Underworld. It's very much all based on sort of Greek myth, isn't it?
Of course, yes.
Anethas, Athens, Cethus, Theseus, Soldeeds, Daedalus, and
Krinoth, Corinth.
Nymon's the Minotaur, obviously. Skonos is Knossos. Sesam, I think, is meant to be Moses. Sorak, I think, is meant to be Icarus, who was Daedalus' son. They go to all that trouble, and they go and call Janet Ellis' character Tika. And I can't for life me work out what that's meant to be. I mean, Theseus's squeeze in that story is Ariadne. Tika. I'm quite not sure what that's going to be.
Her first name, of course, was Chicken. So there was a line in the original script, there was a line that said, Chicken Tika, tell me what's wrong.
This sort of takes a bit far when they have Tika saying Seth's going to destroy the Nymon. His father's keeping a lookout so that he can have a welcome party ready. I mean, that's sort of talk about the Theseus story a bit too much. And then they complete it at the end where the Doctor says, I'm glad I remembered rather than to paint the ship white this time.
And it's still not painted, is it? It's still grey. Because they didn't have time to do it.
A good explosion right at the end. I really like the desiccated corpse effect. You know, where they touch
yes,
it. And it's,
yes, yes. The husk. Mm.
And of course, it's not only the last Graham Williams story, not only the last story with the time tunnel, not only this last story with the diamond logo, but the last story with Delia's music in it.
Yes, is it the last story with Dudley Simpson as well as the main...
Yes, I think it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is.
So, not a bad story, but it's not one I'd particularly want to watch again much. It's more something I would fast-forward through to some of my favourite bits rather than just watch it. And so we've installed a soundproof television booth in the Hoosium Library for you, Mark.
Right.
Especially for you. Do you want to give this scores out of 10? I would give it a 6.
I'm going to give it a 3.
Really? Mm-hmm. Gosh.
Sorry, Mark. I feel bad now. He's going to give it 10, isn't he?
No, that would be mad.
Let him. Let's see if he enjoyed it.
Oh, of course. Of course.
There are clearly other stories of Doctor Who that I enjoy more and are more satisfying all round. But yeah, this one does have a place in my heart and it is just incredibly good fun, I find. Would I like all of Doctor Who to be like this? Not at all. It's difficult with this because I'm aware of some of its failings, but it's just, to go with my heart, I'll give it a 9.
God.
Which seems ridiculous. But that's how much I like it. If you want me to give it a critical score, then that's very difficult because...
I feel faint. You know,
because this exists in an area where, like I said earlier, my vision is like that of the Nymon.
We should publicise the Peter Davison votes, because we've already got one in, haven't we?
Was it Johnny Dab?
There it is, yeah, Johnny Dab.
Yeah, he often sends us nice messages.
So yeah, we probably should publicise that then. Start getting votes in and maybe do that a couple of episodes down as well.
We'll have to at least wait before we do that until I've seen Planet of Fire.
Mm.
And The King's Demons. Anything else I've missed? Let's have a look.
I haven't seen Four to Doomsday for ages, possibly since Broadcast. Ark of Infanity. Ark of Infanity? Well, I don't know what Infanity is.
I bet you haven't seen Ark of Infinity either.
No, funny enough. Is that the prequel?
So I've never seen The Awakening either.
I haven't seen Frontios since I was on holiday in Greece back in the 90s.
No, I was on holiday in Greece, but...
what a holiday.
No, I'd need to watch The Awakening. I'd need time to wipe Frontios from my memory and The King's Demons. So, faithless listeners, our next retrospective is going to be of the Fifth Doctor's Era. So if you'd like to send us your favourite 5 stories, top 5, either on Facebook or by email or on Twitter or whatever, all the ways you can contact us are on the credits at the end of this podcast. Right, in that case, well, I think we shall bring things to a close. Oh, look, here come the Sons of Skaro Daleks. Dalek Skaros, have you got a message for us?
Emergency regulations! Please do not dump bodies into the river.
Dalek Ray, Dalek Ray. We have anti-Dalek force ships in Sector 27.
It's a trap!
Bye-bye, everyone.
Bye-bye.
You have been listening to the Diddly Dum Podcast. Find us on our blog at diddlydumpodcast.wordpress.com, on iTunes, Facebook, Audioboo, and Stitcher.com at diddlydum, on Twitter at diddly_dum, or email us at diddlydumpodcast@yahoo.co.uk.
Diddly Dum! The empty space that circles time. I mean, time, Jesterton.